Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Well, what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the host of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Missing Maura Murray podcast. Lance, how are you tonight?
Doing very well. How are you?
I'm doing well, too. And we have a doozy for this episode, don't we?
Yes, we have a doozy. It's something that I feel like a lot of the listeners have been waiting for. I know I've been waiting for. I believe you have been waiting for the opportunity to talk to James Renner again, and we got him back on the show. My adrenaline was pumping during this. It was a good debate.
And debate, I think, is the right word. But we also knew that we had to ask him some of the tough questions that we never really asked him before. And our interview style on this show doesn't really breed like combative conversations. Because we just like to hear someone out and we ask questions about their thinking, that kind of thing. But this one, we did push back against James a little bit because we just felt like we had to, right?
Yeah. I don't even know if it was a pushback. It was more along the lines of we would establish a point. He would question it. He would establish a point. We would question it. It was really holding both parties accountable for positions that each party has taken. He takes a certain position in this case and publicly puts it out there. And I don't think there's been a whole lot of continuing questioning of the why. I was happy with the way this turned out as we continued to question, where did you get the information? How did you come to this conclusion? Which he did to us as well. It was like kind of sparring in an interview. It was something that was long overdue, I think, for Tim and I and for the show.
Yeah. And of course, James's book, True Crime Addict, came out last May. So if you are interested in reading more about that, check that out on Amazon.
Oddly enough, we didn't get too much into the book during this conversation because of the spirited debate that occurred.
So let's play the interview with James Renner. And please go to blueapron.com/missing to get your first 3 meals free with free shipping. All right, James Renner, welcome back to the Missing Maura Murray podcast. It's been a while. How's things going?
Things are good. Can't complain. I'm trying to transition away from true crime into the world of fiction and murder mysteries. I want to write about crimes that I can actually solve, you know? Put a nice ending on a story. Not take myself too seriously anymore. So that's the goal. I'm doing very limited interviews about these cases, and you know, you guys invited me on, you know, one more time, and I figured I'd do this. But you know, there's, you know, as you guys know, there's a lot of interest in reality TV now, what they call unscripted television. Everybody wants a crime show, and I'm sure you guys are getting approached left and right, because I know I am. And I'm turning a lot of these things down, a lot of these projects down, because, you know, I want to do things that are a little bit more fun and not so tragic. And beyond that, I am personally convinced that Mora is alive and doesn't want to be found. And so I don't know what the end game here is anymore. I don't know what a good, I don't think there's a good ending for this. So, I am not pursuing her. I'm not trying to find her anymore because I do believe she's out there and I believe she has a kid and doesn't want to be found. So as an adult, she's allowed to do that. And, that's kind of where I've come to.
Now we'll get to that in one moment. I just want to point out that, I don't know how many offers you got today, Tim, but I'm in the dozens. My agent is turning away. I mean, I could show you my phone. It literally started to overheat.
It's because you have one of those Galaxy 7s.
I would be very surprised if you guys haven't been approached by a couple different places.
I personally think I have a face for podcasting and a voice for TV. So what makes you so convinced that she was pregnant?
Well, I go back to the first interview I had with Lieutenant Scarinza, the guy that was in charge of the case for the longest time. And, you know, they found these searches on Moore's computer before she disappeared, that she was searching on the internet for information about drinking while pregnant. And Scarinza, at the time that I talked to him, was very certain that, you know, in his mind, he believed she was pregnant and when she disappeared. And when I look at this, I think if she is alive, what would compel her to remain hidden all these years? And the easiest answer there, the most logical answer, is that she was pregnant, that she had a kid. I suspect the father would have been Bill Rausch, and she wishes to remain hidden because she doesn't want that kid to ever have to go in front of a judge for custody. She doesn't want Bill to have anything to do with it. And I think that is motivation enough for her to not reach out to family and friends. And I think she has other reasons not to reach out to family as well. So that's kind of where that's where I'm at. I think all the evidence points to the fact that that she was getting away, that she was in the process of running away. And I think the only thing that makes sense with the scene of the accident and what happened to her is that she was picked up by a tandem driver. And then the question becomes, well, if she was picked up by a tandem driver, why haven't they said anything? And the reason is simple. They don't want to blow her cover. They don't want her to be found either because she doesn't want to be found.
I know that Tim and I are both like salivating to follow up. So Tim, you go.
So you don't believe that she was drinking while she was on her way up to New Hampshire then?
I don't know that she was the one that was drinking. I think she might have been. I think, maybe what she was looking into is how much she could drink without it being harmful to the kid. I know even now, you know, some doctors will say it's fine to have a glass of wine. It's fine to have one drink, a day while you're pregnant. Maybe that's why she was looking into it. So it might have been her drinking. It might have been somebody else. I think she was probably in that car by herself. And the person that was driving with her was in a vehicle in front of her. And when she got in the accident, they saw that she wasn't behind them anymore. And doubled back and picked her up. One of the big things that I keep going back at is if we're to believe anything else happened to Mora Murray, we have to believe that she never told anybody that she was going up to the White Mountains because they would have come forward and said that. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe that. I've asked women, young women, if they've ever done that, if they've ever gone off on their own and never said anything to anybody about their plans, never left a note or an email about what they were doing. And at first, you know, the response I'll get is, oh, yeah, yeah, I needed a mental health day. I took off and I didn't tell anybody where I was going. And I said, now think about that and ask yourself if that's really true. And they'll come back with, well, I left a note for my roommate just so she wouldn't worry. Or I emailed my mother or something like that. Nobody just goes off and does that. So, again, the logical explanation is Maura did tell somebody or her friends or a couple people what she was doing. And the reason that they haven't come forward and said that is because they don't want to blow her cover. Because there's a reason not to do that, and that reason is a kid. You know, I believe that sighting at Butson's that happened there.
I just want to interrupt you for a second. I got a question. Why not have an abortion?
I think she wanted to keep the kid. And you know, so you're saying if she didn't want custody, if she was so afraid that she had to leave her life,
yeah,
would abortion be a simpler explanation? I think that goes to her upbringing. I think more than anything else, she's a Catholic girl at heart. You know, I think she wanted a kid. I think she saw an opportunity to get away. And I think she had help from an abused women's network. You know, a woman who worked for this place called House of Ruth contacted me a little over a year ago and said that she believed that Maura used House of Ruth in order to get away and start a new life. And you look into these organizations for abused and battered women, they work as well, if not better, than witness protection. They make somebody disappear. And I think she had reason because, you know, you look into what happened with Bill Rausch since the disappearance, and it goes to his character. The whole reason he lost his job at Ray Group International, which you can, you know, this is backed up, not just because I've talked to the five women that he worked with and verified that this happened, but I've talked to Bill Rausch himself, who admits that he lost that job after there were allegations of sexual assault on a woman there. So, you know, I think Maura would never want to have a kid with Bill and saw an opportunity to get away.
Now, you said that there's so many questions I'm writing down right now, so we're going to end up backtracking a bit and then we'll get back on track, I'm sure. But one thing is the fact that – and just answer it in a yes or no. Do you think that she had a solid upbringing?
No. Absolutely not. It was a tumultuous family and family situation. Her relationship with her mother was untenable. So if you're asking for yes or no answer, the answer is no. It wasn't a good relationship. When she was with Haas, this guy she was this track coach she was with for a while, they were having a little affair.
Was he engaged or with a girlfriend or married?
I don't know.
And was she?
She was with Bill.
I just have a problem when people call it an affair. I just think that it makes it sound a little too lurid. How old were they?
I mean, they were very young, but no doubt about it, Maura was with Bill. Haas knew about Bill. They all knew about Bill. She was stepping out.
But everybody says that Billy and her were breaking up at the time.
No, they were very much together during the course of that relationship. I don't think they were breaking up because they were promised to be engaged. This engagement was going to happen. She was making plans to go to Fort Sill.
That's coming from Billy, who said that to the newspaper reporters after she went missing, that I wasn't, her father doesn't know, but we were engaged to be engaged. So now we're taking somebody who has women abuse allegations and a questionable character. We're taking that part for fact.
This is coming from Haas. This is coming from Kate Markopoulos, you know, during our conversations, you know, where they were at in their relationship and what was going on. We know, you know, Maura was with Bill all that Christmas vacation, you know, right before she disappeared too.
Okay.
But the reason you mentioned Haas is because when they were together, Moore never, ever mentioned Fred. Never mentioned Fred once. In fact, Haas told me, he said, I didn't even know her father was still around. You know, he could have been dead as far as I know. So, no, Fred was living outside of the house. He was living up in Weymouth. They had separated after Kurt came along. The relationship between Moore and Julie was very strained. Kathleen's doing her own thing. Moore was very close with Kurt. That relationship was solid, you know, and that would be a hard one to walk away from, for sure.
What do you think then, like, could have happened from the time where Moore got pregnant with Billy's kid and decided to run away from him? Like, what, you know, like, if she had sex with him, obviously, you know, and the relationship is strong, and then he goes to Oklahoma and she goes back to UMass, and then all of a sudden something happens that tells her that he's not a good guy?
No, I think, and this is, you know, again, this is speculation. I believe she's alive. I believe she was pregnant. I believe that was the motivation. So what you're asking me is what changed? What changed is Moore found out she was pregnant. That was the impetus. That was what started her off on this trip. I need to leave.
Things that Moore did before she left. She looked up directions to go Stowe, to Brenton Woods. This is all proven fact, right? Okay. She looked up the effects of drinking when pregnant. I just want to put a side note on that she was also a nursing student. And if she was pregnant, has there been anybody that you know of in her nursing program that she could have simply asked instead of looking up the effects of being pregnant? Has anyone that you've spoke to ever said, yeah, Moore asked me what the effects are of drinking when pregnant?
No. I've spoken to a couple people that were in the program with her at the time.
So she did some extensive computer internet researching before she left. With your theory, how far along, and I do have a point, I'm not just rambling. With your theory, how far along was she in her pregnancy, do you think?
I think she probably just found out. I mean, they were only, I think it was 2 or 3 weeks into the spring semester. So, you know, I think probably very early on.
It's really tough for me to think that she just found out she was pregnant, looked up these directions, looked up the effect of drinking, but yet there's no search on women underground, battered women underground railroads. There's no search on how to avoid the world and maintain custody of a child when you don't want your family and boyfriend to know about it. There's nothing that suggests that. And there's nothing suggesting that, unless there's some, like, something we don't know about, but there's nothing suggesting that when all of her actions beforehand are pretty well documented and pretty straightforward.
You know what else there's not?
Yes. Give it to me.
What else we're missing is she doesn't get anywhere with her reservation. She doesn't find a place to stay. She calls this Linda Salamone, who had this condo up in New Hampshire, which, by the way, it was a 2-bedroom condo. She's driving past Nootka Lodge, which had nice single rooms. She's searching for condos and places with more than one bedroom. So that, to me, says she's not traveling alone either. But then she doesn't find a place, right? The reason is she's working with somebody else. She's got a friend there that's also looking for reservations. This friend is the one that actually made the reservations, found a place to stay. That's why we don't have it, because somebody else got it before her. They were trading phone calls. She was in their room, perhaps. But so the reason why we don't have an internet search for, like, House of Ruth or something like that, I would think there's a couple different explanations. Either the friend did it. She did it on the friend's computer. Or she had this thought in the back of her mind and had researched it for months. And the trigger was that kid that she had researched, you know, these battered women shelters, had that idea in mind, But the go for it was this kid. So I think perhaps she already had that info.
The math doesn't work with the tandem driver.
Why not? Of course it does. The tandem driver is the only way that accident scene makes sense. You've got the Westmans, you've got John Marot, you've got Butch Atwood. Picture it as like three lighthouses.
Hey, you're forgetting Forcier too.
Okay, well, Forcier's Forcier. You know, I don't buy a word into what Forcier said or saw that night. So, but we've got three people that are watching the crime scene, and it's dark out, right? And these three, one at a time, they're kind of watching the crime scene at one point or another. So I pictured in my mind as like these strobes of light that are illuminating the scene, and they'll watch for 10 seconds or so, and then they'll look away and watch Jeopardy, and then they'll turn back to it. So you have these windows of 10 to 20 seconds of darkness where Maura disappeared. And she disappeared in one of those spots where nobody was watching that scene. But those spots were so small that there's no way somebody else could have come up that she didn't know and taken her away, because there would have been that conversation. There would have been, oh, hey, what happened? Oh, I broke down. Do you need some help? Yeah, let me get my things. And that would have taken about a minute, in which case somebody would have seen that. But if it was somebody she knew, that other vehicle, that animal driver, could have swooped in, more hop in. They're in, they're gone, 10 seconds. That's how nobody saw anything, because it was that quick.
So the tandem driver was behind her?
No, the tandem driver was in front of her. The tandem driver was leading,
yep.
Probably because they had the reservations. They knew where they were going. They're leading. Maura gets into the accident. They either see it in their rear view or notice that she's not behind them. They turn around and they pick her up. I think they noticed that she was no longer behind them. And say a mile or two down the road, they turn around, they come back and pick her up. You're shaking your head now.
I'm shaking my head no, because if it's a mile or two, so they're already over that hill going into Bath at that point. And she's had the accident, or maybe she just has the accident.
Right.
And then enough time goes by where they say, oh, man, where'd she go? I'm going to have to turn around. It's not a whole lot of places to turn around there. So they have to do this like three-point turn in the road. So that takes a little bit of time, or even finding a place to turn around takes time. They turn around. So if she gets into the accident between like 7:20 and 7:25, right? Because Faith calls it 7:27, so we can't really say that she got into the accident any earlier than that, right? 7:20?
Yeah.
Right.
Right. So Faith never says that anybody came and picked her up. Butch is there. He never sees anybody. And soon after, the police are there. I just don't – and I just don't see – I just don't see somebody who – I just don't see the timing. Like, I just don't see it's incredible timing. It's incredibly fortunate timing for somebody to realize that she's not behind them, to do that turn, to come up onto the scene and drive by, hey, hop in, and it just happens to be that 10 seconds where nobody sees it, because nobody says anything about that.
Well, whatever happened, nobody saw it.
Somebody saw it.
Nobody saw her disappear.
No, somebody saw it. Whatever happened, somebody saw it. If somebody took her, somebody, it was a tandem or, yeah.
But none of the, you know, none of the neighbors saw it.
But you can't even say that for certain. Somebody might have saw something that they didn't want to see.
Nah, I don't buy that at all.
Why?
You know, why? Because I've talked to the Westmans. I've talked to Atwood's wife. And I've talked to Marat. I've talked to everybody that was there. I believe when they tell me that they didn't see anything. And this idea that they saw somebody that they're afraid to talk about is—it's just goddamn ridiculous.
So you talk to the Westmans and you take what they say as truth when these are the same people that have said after 3 months of searching, what could they possibly be looking for? Even today, even on the 13-year anniversary, they still rope off the old weathered barn. They don't want to talk to anybody. They want to be left alone, and that's
and
fine.
They want property signs up.
Yeah, private property signs. They've called the cops on people. Maybe they don't want the attention because they saw something that they didn't want to see. I am not saying that that is my particular theory. I'm just saying that it is something that you can't just look at and say, well, the Westman said this, so I'm going to say, you know, the Westmans probably wanted you to go away. You know, when we talked to the Westmans, they just wanted us to go away.
But if we're here analyzing people's behavior, I think it's fair. It's a fair point to analyze their behavior like that.
I'd like to look at the probability, and the probability is in my mind that there is no conspiracy here, that the Westmans and Marat and Atwood are not covering from somebody or for somebody, that they honestly don't know. And they don't know because they weren't looking at the moment that she disappeared.
Sure. But I'm not saying that it's a total conspiracy with the Westmans, the Marats, and the Atwoods coming together and saying, you know, at a town hall meeting or like some smoky room where they're getting together and saying, you know, well, we're not talking about this incident ever again. I just think that they just want to be left alone. So you can't formulate a theory based on like the way people be.
Let's say this. Let's say hypothetically, the Westmans saw something that scared them so much that they don't want anything to do with it. They saw somebody with Mora, but they're keeping it secret. Why in the world didn't they move?
No, all I'm saying, I'm not saying they did see something. I said in the beginning that this wasn't my theory. I wasn't trying to make this into a theory. I'm just saying that the type of people that they are, you can't just say, hey, I believe them. Hey, they didn't see anything. But then at the same time, say, Mora suddenly found – Mora had this confidant that is so closely – close-knit with her that they are not going to talk for 13 years, and they know goddamn well that something's going on.
Yeah, let's get into that.
It's honestly not a big deal if you have a child.
They can't come forward because if they were to come forward, suddenly Bill has all these rights that, you know, suddenly Mora's cover's blown. We know she's out there. We know she's living. We know she disappeared with a kid. You know, Bill and his mother are going to be after that, you know, in a second.
Why though? Bill's married with a kid of his own. Like what, wouldn't that be really awkward if that were to happen? Why would he want,
it's Bill's mother. It's Sharon. You know, it's like a grandmother. You tell me a grandmother wouldn't want to see their kid. Mora would also be possibly facing charges for running off with this kid and keeping it a secret from the father.
Kidnapping her own kid? What?
The father has some sort of rights in this. A mother can't just take a kid away from the father and disappear.
Where did she have the baby?
I have no idea. Wherever she ended up with.
But also, how hard is he really going to fight for that if he's like you know, been accused of this sexual assault and he knows that he's guilty of this? Like he doesn't want this public. He declined coming on this podcast, so he doesn't really want to talk much about that. So I don't think she's hiding from him right now. I can't imagine, like, she's not physically afraid of him now, even if she was at one point, or and then certainly not of her family. I can't imagine.
And again, this is the conclusion that I've come up with. You know, I will preface it by saying, in a world of, you know, Ariel Castro's, I'm not going to be 100% sure, but my strong feeling is that she's alive. And of course, if it was Bill's kid, that's motivation for her to keep hidden. She wouldn't want that to be a custody issue. And as soon as she comes out of there, the courts are going to be involved, or the grandparents are going to want to be involved. That kid is going to want some sort of connection there that she wouldn't want.
I don't know, man. I know people who, I'm thinking about it right now, who have had children who have had custody issues and have had bad family dynamics. And I just don't know. Like, it's not that bad. It's.
We don't know how bad it was. We don't know how bad it was.
Or how bad you're saying it was. I don't know how it was, period.
Every family's like, got some issues.
I mean, there's issues, and then there's like issues that you run away from for 13 years, and you only have one confidant who is so is so solid. They're not talking in 13 years. It just makes it really pushes the boundaries for me.
Well, especially because I feel like they weren't that good of friends, right? Kate and Sarah with Moore.
I don't know if we've actually named a name
yet. Well, I would assume that would be the confidants we were talking about. I could be wrong, though. Well, one of them was. We don't know. Okay.
He's got a couple of close friends that, you know, Kate Markopoulos was a very close friend. They shared a lot together. You know, I don't know how close she was with Sarah, but, and, you know, I don't know if ultimately she would be the ones that she told. But what's the alternative here? If this isn't what happened to Maura Murray, what did? If she was murdered, where's the body? I will say this, you know, a scene that needs to be searched, because I don't think her, you know, she certainly didn't wander into the woods and die because, you know, she's succumbed to the elements. That's not a possibility. Anybody that's been up to the crime scene knows that right away. It's not as desolate as people have in their minds. I mean, this is there are lots of houses in the area. She would have had to walk through somebody's yard, and that didn't happen. So if she was murdered, her body certainly wasn't dumped around that site because it's been searched with a fine-tooth comb around there within a five-mile radius, not just by Fred and family, but by Fish and Game, who did an organized search twice with hundreds of volunteers. But I will tell you, they should do an organized search around the UMass outing club cabin. I don't know what to make of it, but you know I know in my mind she wasn't traveling alone, and there's one or two other explanations for that, but. When we found out about the outing club cabin, and I contacted the guy that runs the place, and I said, hey, let me just give you a list of names of people Maura knew. Maybe we'll have a connection here. And he got back right away, and he said, yeah, Haas. Haas was up here. Haas was part of the outing club. He knew this. He could have easily told Maura about it. Was that her ultimate destination? And if it was, then we need a more organized search up there. Perhaps her body's around the outing club cabin, but I'll tell you, I just have this sense that she's alive.
Looking back on everything that's happened in the past few years with this, is there anything that – I hate this question, and I'm sorry I'm asking you, and you know what I'm going to ask you, but is there anything that you would have done differently with this?
Yeah, for sure. I wouldn't have called her a sociopath. That's for damn sure.
And you would have got away with it if it wasn't for us kids.
Right, right. At the time, we had all this evidence that you know that I was becoming more and more convinced that she was alive, and I couldn't find any reason for her to want to do that other than being just a you know a jerk, you know. And then I learned about Bill Rausch, and suddenly you know there's motivation to want to get away. So no, I don't believe she was a sociopath. I believe she was a survivor, and the evidence and her actions leading up to that disappearance could be viewed as, you know, sociopathic behavior, but I think it's also survival and survival behavior.
I'm not trying to be the Nancy Grace of the whole thing here, but
Lancy Grace.
But you say she's a survivor. Why wouldn't her survival instincts kick in when she realizes she's pregnant and she says, fuck all these people around me. I'm having this kid. I'm not going to run. What she did was run. Survivors don't run. They stand up.
Well, I think at that point, the maternal instinct kicked in, and I think she realized the safest place for her kid was anywhere that wasn't the woman couldn't be found. I think she wanted to get away from a couple specific people in her life, Bill being one of them. And yeah, I think the maternal instinct kicked in, and let's have a do over.
I'm not a woman, and I feel like
if I only were,
damn. I don't even know if we should get into it. Maybe we should cut it later. But don't you think it's a little soon for a maternal instinct to kick in when she just found out she was pregnant?
Well, I think no, I don't, because I look back on when I found out that my wife was pregnant, and the kids were coming. I mean, that really does change something right away. It makes you think outside yourself. It makes you want to actually protect yourself a little bit more in order for you to be responsible for this kid that's coming. It's a huge responsibility.
So at the same time, she goes online and looks up how much alcohol it would take to harm a baby.
You know, I think she was maybe worried that she had been drinking in those weeks leading up to when she found out she was pregnant. You know, I don't know. It makes sense to me. It makes sense that she would be concerned about how much she was drinking, or that she had been drinking so much it was hard to quit completely. So how much can I have without hurting baby? You know, I've known a lot of people like that, you know, that flirt with the edge, that have this, you know, great maternal instinct and are great mothers, but at the same time, just can't set the booze down, can't walk away from it for a day.
But we're painting her like she was an alcoholic. It was nothing. Yeah, like she was an alcoholic. There's nothing saying she was an alcoholic.
Oh, I think there's plenty of evidence suggesting she had a drinking problem. She's drinking Bailey's in her morning coffee. She got at West Point.
Where did that information come?
The Bailey's in the morning coffee? That's from that's from Bill's mom.
Bill's mom? The crazy grandmother.
I never called her crazy. Any grandmother would want to see her.
I don't know if you didn't call her crazy, but the tone of your voice made me picture like Joan Crawford.
Right. No more wire hangers. She just doesn't like wire hangers.
Right.
No, you know, no other explanation in my mind makes sense. Certainly not this crazy convoluted cop theory. I'll tell you what, I'm going to go off on a tangent here. You know what your witness A saw that day? She saw Cecil Smith. At the scene, Cecil Smith shows up because he processed the scene, and she sees this. It sticks in her mind, and she starts talking about it after that. And then John Smith hears about this. And let me back up a little bit and tell you about this little experiment that we did in college. I took some psychology classes, and they gave us extra credit to be part of this psychological study. And they sat us in a room and they showed us a video, and it was a robbery. And it was a robbery taking place where this guy broke into this woman's house and he stole a bunch of stuff and put it in his bag and left. And then we took a questionnaire, and they asked us a bunch of questions about what we saw. And we had to write it down. And one of the questions was, how many necklaces did the robber take? And I had to think for a second. I'm like, oh, yeah, definitely three necklaces. And then they show you the video afterwards, and they show you he never took any necklaces. But because of the way the question was worded, it reshaped our memory of it. And what's happened here is witness A has talked to John Smith and has talked to Alec, and they have worded their questions in a way that over the span of many years – she has become convinced that she saw this magical SUV, the 001, park there, and it was Jeff Williams, and he was drunk, and you know, and it's become this insane conspiracy where what she really saw was Cecil Smith, and everything else has been, and essentially what John Smith has done is taint a witness, which, you know, is enough for him to be charged with obstruction of justice. There are a number of things that he's gone off the rails with. One of them is calling himself an investigator when he doesn't have a private investigator's license. So he's also impersonating an officer. So the fact that this guy is still out there and not charged with something boggles the mind.
I definitely understand what you're saying and thinking that Witness A could be off on what she says. Obviously, that's proven that witness testimony is shaky at best. But I will definitely say 100% that John Smith or Alex Clogston did not taint Witness A, Karen. She emailed the Murray family very early on, before she even knew who John Smith was. She would have actually known who Alex was, but only through her son, not because of any of this.
Seen that email?
I have not seen that email, but there is absolutely no way.
I would like to see that email, and I want to see in that email, I want to see where it says 001. I want to see the SU. I want to see those details. And if those details are on there, I will eat a hat. Literally, I will find a hat made out of like fruit roll-ups, and I will eat it for you.
Well, I think we might have a hit video on our YouTube page coming up, because
you can't cop out and eat a fruit roll-up hat. You have to eat like a straw hat. I will eat a hat made of filet mignon for you.
But I don't believe John never even spoke to her. I don't think until this whole thing happened. Until 2015 was the earliest.
And
John,
I think that's when she started saying the BS about the 001. I would be so surprised if you can get that email and show that her story has not changed. I will be flummoxed.
Okay, we will try that for sure.
She's never given any impression to me that she was lying. Now you're saying it's a misremembering thing. It's a you think you have seen something, and with enough suggestion, you've seen something. But she has said since the beginning, since the beginning, before she knew Alex and John Smith, when she went to the police. And told them what she saw very soon after the incident. And they said, no, it was a sedan. She said, I know it was an SUV. Like, I know it was 001. It was.
How do you know that's what she said?
How do I know for certain that's what she said to the police?
Yeah.
All I'm operating on is the fact that I met her, and she seems like an extremely genuine person. And
John Smith clockworked orange that lady. She doesn't remember anything that happened that long ago that you could say for 100% that she's remembering correctly. He's screwed with their mind.
But they told her the SUV was in the shop at the time. Like, if she said it was a car, they would have just said, "Oh, you saw Cecil Smith."
Again, we're going off her recollections, and I don't put any sort of faith in her memory. Because it's been tampered.
But this is before she spoke to John or Alex or anyone.
But you're only hearing this afterwards. Like, you're still going off her memory of these things. I think her memory's faulty. I think it's been screwed with. I think it's been tampered with.
In writing True Crime Addict, your theory has changed a couple times. So what is that like to write a book and your ending, your theory changes as you go?
Well, I think the ending to the book is where I'm at right now. You know, I end the book saying, you know, if this is what happened, you know, the book ends with the revelation of what happened with Bill Rauch in D.C. and how he lost his job there. And I say at the end there, you know, if she left to protect a kid, then I hope she remains missing. So, you know, I think for me, what solidified that was this terrible thing that happened back in October, where I became convinced that we found Moore's Facebook profile, that it was this. It turned out to be a hoax by another one of these internet trolls. Who made this profile. You know, of course, it didn't say Moore Murray, but it was a woman's name, and it had the same birth date. And then it had this person went to lengths to find pictures of kids that looked so much like the Murrays and so much like Fred, and would have been the age that this kid would be
and
now.
And you couldn't reverse Google search it.
And you couldn't, right. So they went to great lengths. And I thought then, oh, my God, this is her. And, you know, now we've kind of outed her. And, you know, that to me was the moment where I realized that I have some sort of responsibility here is that at this point, if I found her, I wouldn't tell anybody, you know. And, you know, if anybody does find her, you know, and we're not the only people looking for her now. You know, I've asked other people, you know, don't tell law enforcement, don't tell police if you find her, because if you tell police, here's what happens. They will verify it and then they'll close the case. And you know what happens when you close a case? All that information becomes public record. Fred can get that. Moore doesn't want, if she's out there hiding, she doesn't want anybody to find her. Doesn't want Bill to find her, doesn't want Fred to find her. So we can't tell anybody if we find her. We just can't.
Do you really think that she, like, has this all in her head? Like, it's, she has a, if so, she has a 13-year-old child with her. What is she telling her child? Her child must be asking questions. How does she enroll her child into school? Where is she? Is she in America? Is she in Canada? I mean, it's not that easy to do. It's not that easy to, I mean, maybe you could. It's not, like, impossible, but
these battered women shelters, they can hook you up. They can get you a name. They can get you a new name. With a new name, you can get a new soch. You can. She might not. I mean, it's possible that she's still in the United States. She's using somebody else's name.
Hey, she was described recently by Fred Jr. as not street smart at all, like very very book smart, but not street smart. So yeah, I do find that. That difficult to do. It's difficult to do if you were street smart.
Yet, and yet we have a missing woman who we know in November of that year stole somebody else's ID, stole somebody else's credit card, and didn't think twice of doing it.
There was also many other people. We've spoken to people about that credit card incident, and they said that she wasn't the only one that did that. It was a credit card number that kind of floated around.
I've not heard that.
Oh. Yeah, it was like kind of a community thing.
I mean, you look at I've seen the credit card statements, right?
Sure. Yeah. So have we.
You would see those other charges. The only charges that Moore got busted for were the ones that she was signing for that were going to her room. There's no other charges on the card. I suspect that whoever told you that was feeding you a line. And there's only a couple people that could have said that. I mean, we're talking about Kate Markopoulos. We're talking about Sarah Alfieri, or we're talking about this other girl that recently came forward from the track team that is doing everything she can to ghostlight anybody that suggests that Moore is still alive.
I don't know what ghostlight means.
Do you want to share where that info came from?
All I'm saying is phrasing something like she stole this and she stole that and didn't bat an eye. But when you look into it a little bit deeper, there are instances of credit card numbers kind of going around, like, here, write down this credit card number if you need something. It's her father's credit card. I don't think – I mean, saying, like, it makes people think she, like, pickpocketed or, like, looked at it, wrote it down. It was a piece of paper – it was a piece of paper that could have been floating, like it could have been passed to her from somebody else saying, hey, I got this.
No. That's a line that you were told that there's no verification. All we know for a fact is Moore used a stolen credit card number and signed for it.
Right. She didn't steal the credit card.
She stole the number.
Right.
Steal the card. She stole the number.
Right. Right. So where did you get the line? Where did you get the line that she stole a credit card?
I should say number. She stole a credit card number.
Which other people might have done, and there might have been other credit card numbers, which we were told. That there was instances of other credit card numbers that were floating around.
What proof do we have of that?
What proof do you have of that she was, like, going into it?
We have proof that Moore had Moore used this credit card number that she signed for. That's the only proof we have.
There's a police record of the owner of the credit card.
And there's record where the police say, where did you get this number? Moore goes to her dresser, pulls out this card with the number, and hands it to him. The only person we know that ever had those credit card numbers was the person who owned the card, and Moore Murray. this whole idea that it was passed around.
Not that particular credit card number. All I'm saying was that it was not uncommon that if somebody had a credit card and there was a number and they gave it to somebody else, like, hey, this is my parents' card, order some food, here's the number, that person might have passed it off to somebody else. Not that particular number.
That's a silly made-up story that is so trying to...
You think that college kids, everyone else but Maura, wouldn't do something like that. That Maura is the only person who would look at a credit card and write it down. That no one else would have looked at a credit card, any credit card, written down the number and passed it off to their roommate at some point.
I don't know anybody that did it. Do you? I mean, I don't know anybody that would steal a credit card number and try to use it in college.
Yeah, I absolutely know.
My friends did that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Morgan got caught for it, you know? And it was enough that it could have ended her nursing career before it started. And if she had just kept out of trouble for 6 months, it would have gone away. And then she got in this accident in Hadley. And it was likely coming back.
She did get caught for it. And she had 6 months, right? Probation? Or pseudo-probation?
But it had to be 6 months to keep her nose clean, and then it would get wiped off. She had this accident in Hadley. So you add that accident and the fact that she was going to be charged with, at the very least, reckless operation. Add the pregnancy on top of that. She's got a lot of motivation. She's got a lot of motivation to take that moment to head out, to light out for the territories.
Seems pretty organized, though, if you're at that moment, your head's all over the place, you're pregnant, you got these charges, all these things going on in your life, the boyfriend, all these things. It seems very, very organized to actually pull off running away at that point in your life for 13 years.
I think she'd been thinking about it for a while. I think she'd been thinking about it for months. I mean, go back to Haas again. Haas, you know, either Haas is telling me the truth or he's lying. You know, and what Haas said was that Maura talked about running away. Maura talked about running away, and he always thought Mexico. So either Haas is telling the truth, and I feel as though he is, and Maura was talking about running away, and then she runs away, or Haas is lying. You know, and then that becomes a whole other can of worms.
Why do you feel like he's telling you the truth?
It's just that it's that journalistic instinct. I've talked to a lot of good liars, you know, for the same reason that when I talked to Kate Markopoulos, I felt as though she was being untruthful.
And for the same reason why when we talk to Witness A, I feel like she's being truthful.
Okay.
So, James, why did you archive your blog?
A couple reasons. I no longer have the time to keep up on the comment section, and there's a lot of threats and a lot of garbage that comes through that comment section. And right now I'm focusing on a television show. I'm focusing on a new book and a couple other projects. And, I got to the point where, you know, I wanted to do something a little more fun and, enjoyable. And then this, you know, when I became convinced more and more that Maura was alive, again, you know, it comes back to the responsibility that I have of not, not revealing where she is, you know? So, I think it's, but at the same time, and if I was 100%, I'd just take the blog down. But, I'm not. You know, again, there are Ariel Castros out there, and there's that one in a million chance that this is a case that is something we've never come across before. So it's up there for people to research and see all the documents and see the history of it. But I also wanted to make it easier for her to come forward if she wanted to. So when I archived it, I decided to take out a lot of the more prurient stuff, you know, the stuff that is more about her being a wild, you know, normal young woman in college. You know, things that I've shared in the past where I shared them because, you know, perhaps she was the victim of a murder, and this, you know, this part of her history might shed some light onto, you know, a possible suspect. But since I no longer believe she was a victim of murder, there's no reason to have those things up there anymore. So the stuff that speaks to her character and some of the wild times that she had as a college student, you know, I took down too. So, you know, eventually that'll fade away and go away and not be there to deal with if she ever decides to come forward.
Do you regret putting up those things about the wild times she had in college? Which, how did you know about the wild times she had in college?
From talking to other people that were there, you know, that were a part of those.
When did you talk to them?
Years ago, 3 or 4 years ago. Yeah. So, you know, I, and you know, these people are also now, you know, heads of businessmen and, you know.
So psychopaths.
Yeah, right. So that's why I took that stuff down. And and the comments stuff is, you know, it's not something I want to deal with anymore. But, you know, I leave it up there. It still gets, you know, I still track about 2,000 hits a day. The site's garnered close to 6 million. It's like 5,800,000 hits over the course of the last few years. And, you know, it's, I never thought it would get that big, but.
I'm surprised you dealt with the comments for as long as you did. Like, those comments are about as intense as any blog that's up there.
And the ones you've seen are the ones I've approved. You know, right. You should, the ones that I couldn't.
Can you give us a taste?
Some of them are, you know, threatening, you know, me or my family. And, you know, some of them are just vile. Some of them are attacking Mora. You know, it's just, it's, you know, the internet's the best and worst of humanity, yeah. Especially when you have anonymity. I don't know how you guys do it, you know, and keep coming back. I know at some point it reached a point where I had to quit reading comments and reviews and, you know, things like that. So, you know, I imagine you do best when you don't read through all the YouTube comments and Reddit and just leave it alone and do your thing.
Well, we have each other to bounce it off of. And we've said this before that it's like you did it alone. You know, we have each other to be like, can you believe what this person said? How do we react to this? And it's like, oh, dude, just let it go or just like joke around. It's way easier to get involved with something like this when you have somebody else to support you.